Today, why the big guys always win. The DFA Daily to the 18th of April, 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The Fed continues its money printing, with its balance sheet now up $285 billion more during the week of April the 15th, to a new record high of $6.37 trillion. Since March the 16th, which was a partial bailout week, which ended on March the 18th, their total assets rose by $586 billion, then $557 billion early on, and last week, just $287 billion. And since the Fed announced its market bailouts and interventions on March the 15th, it's printed and handed to Wall Street $2.06 trillion. But that was front-loaded, as in the past couple of weeks, it's cut its bailouts in half. After the big talk of buying all types of securities direct or via its special purpose vehicle, it has mainly bought treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. On April the 10th, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that the Fed would pack away its emergency toolkits once, quote, private markets and institutions were once again able to perform their vital functions of channeling credit and supporting economic growth. So, are we there yet? Well, probably not. The $6.37 trillion of assets on the Fed's balance sheets are mostly composed of treasury securities, mortgage-backed securities, repurchase agreements or repos, foreign central bank liquidity swaps, and loans to its special purpose vehicles. They added $154 billion in treasury securities during the week, while repo balances on the Fed's balance sheet have now dropped $181 billion. The Fed has dollar liquidity swap lines with the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and the central banks of Canada, England, Australia, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, Denmark, Singapore, South Korea, Brazil, and Mexico. And the total on its balance sheet increased by $20 billion from the prior week to $378 billion, with 83% of outstanding liquidity swaps, with the ECB at $138 billion and the Bank of Japan at $176 billion. The Bank of England has just $22 billion, while there were no swaps with central banks of Canada, Brazil, New Zealand and Sweden. The Eurozone and Japan are both export-focused economies with large trade surpluses to the US, and through those surpluses obtain constant flows of dollars, and their currencies are also the second and third largest global reserve currencies. And by the way, the Bank of Japan's foreign exchange reserves includes $1.2 trillion in US Treasury securities. So the Fed has lots of self-interest here, as both these centres need access to these swap lines to support their banks and companies with the large dollar-denominated debt and derivatives. And that's the point. The central bank action is still supporting the financial plumbing, helicopter money for Wall Street and for asset holders. But consider this. If the Fed had spent that $2.06 trillion on the 130 million households in the US, then each household would have received $15,800. And that's the point. For all the talk about supporting lending to businesses and households, this is really a financial system rescue, a situation which has been catalysed by the virus, which was always going to happen. Frankly, COVID is not the culprit, but a convenient excuse. The Fed, like the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan before it, has tried to generate inflation through easy monetary policy with the goal of reducing the real burden of massive debts. But all attempts have been self-defeating because the extra liquidity encourages ever more unproductive borrowing, which can never be repaid. Inflation cannot be marshalled to reduce debt. In the liquidity trap, it will only arrive once those have been written down. Policymakers have been repeating the same mistake for at least 20 years, and the reckoning has now arrived. When the US captains of finance, leading politicians, sports team owners, and media personalities all start calling out the injustice of corporate and hedge fund bailouts, you know that we're in the last innings of the game. Those policies, which no one, not even those who benefit from them, accepts as being fair. Financial historian James Grant has described the Fed as the firemen who are also the arsonists. Having lured investors out into the furthest limb of the risk tree, the Fed has no choice but to play its final hand. And now the Fed and the Treasury have assumed control of the financial system, it is hard to imagine a good, if rational, efficient and transparent mechanism through which the government will pick winners and losers via its asset purchase decisions. Whose debts will be written off? How were those beneficiaries chosen? And what evidence is there that a clean slate will catalyse growth? And what are taxpayers getting in exchange for their generosity? A financial system whose risks have once again been socialised, but whose rewards remain in the limited number of private hands. The taxpayer will hold the bag for defaulted loans, but is not guaranteed an equity stake in the companies the government is bailing out. This looks more and more like a nationalisation of our financial system, yet the public do not have ownership rights. It's perhaps better described as an organised protection racket run by banks, hedge funds, private equity investors and large corporations. And ahead, we suspect there will be a significant risk of cascading defaults in the form of a debtor's strike as households and businesses seek to retain whatever cash they can get their hands on. This outcome seems more likely than back in 2008, which then witnessed strategic defaults by some mortgagors and their old jingle mail. But whatever happens in financial markets, it is unlikely that consumer spending will rebound quickly. Americans will undoubtedly realize that they need a larger margin of safety against unexpected shocks. Household savings will continue to rise, which will slow the recovery in the economy. Absent of a quick resolution of uncertainty surrounding the virus, which we think is highly unlikely, businesses will be dealing with complex and difficult choices that inhibit planning and hiring decisions. Needless to say, the dismantling of global supply chains and rising geopolitical tensions will not help. Some are wondering whether the market can absorb so much liquidity from the fire hose. The more pertinent question, though, is whether, having been such poor stewards of capital over the past decade, the companies who will benefit from this largesse are its proper recipients. The sums allocated to state and local governments, small businesses and households pale into comparison to what large corporations and their investors will get and are inadequate to support the collapsing US economy. And additionally, there is little incentive for bailed out firms to protect their employees. They are green-lighted to fire 10% of their staff over the next 6 months and will undoubtedly be hurrying to get more of that out of the way before the loan documents are signed. There are no employment requirements thereafter. United Airlines has already announced that it will begin layoffs as soon as the 6 months hiatus is over. GM has made a similar announcement. And the bottom line is you cannot revive a consumer-led economy by depriving people who need money to survive while rewarding those who don't need it at all. And to varying degrees, central banks have three levers of power. The first is monetary policy proper, involving the price and quantity of money. Second are the purchases of other assets. And the third is the regulatory authority. And the ECB grabbed this third lever yesterday. It reduced the amount of capital needed to support trading activity for 6 months. Ironically, the ECB explained the reduction in funds put aside as part of its response to, quote, the extraordinary level of volatility. Investors know as volatility equals risk. So at the moment that trading has become riskier, the ECB and other central banks permit greater risk-taking by the banks. It is important in the transmission of monetary policy to ensure markets run smoothly. Market-making functions and the liquidity they provide is essential. There are activities requiring scale, which means banks with large trading operations will, to the largest, be the direct beneficiaries of the reduced capital requirements. and officials are subject to criticism when they take measures that limit market activity, as in the ban on short selling, and they are chastised for favouring large entities over small. Mexico's president, AMLO, requested an advance from Banxico of its profits that are due next year. The central bank, though, refused. The request does not appear to be far from what others are doing, like the UK Treasury, who took unlimited overdraft privileges at the Bank of England this last week. But still, emerging market economies have less latitude when it comes to central bank independence. And just in terms of the relative quantums, President Trump on Friday announced a $19 billion program to help the struggling agricultural sector and distribute food to families in need amid the economic toll of the pandemic. The US Department of Agriculture will purchase crops and livestock from farmers and ranchers facing a steep decline in orders and massive supply chain disruption. Funding will come from the $2.2 trillion Economic Relief Fund and separate USDA funds to support commodity prices. USDA will offer $16 billion in grants to farmers and to ranchers to compensate for short-term drops in demand and oversupply driven by the pandemic. The department will also purchase $3 billion in fresh produce, dairy and meat to distribute to food banks, community organizations and charities. These are great people, great Americans, Trump said after announcing the program during a Friday briefing at the White House. Never complain, they just do what they have to do. The coronavirus food aid programs comes as the economic collapse and social upheaval driven by the pandemic snarls grocery supply lines and creates drastic imbalances across the food industry. As restaurants and schools across the US shutter and millions of Americans are forced to cook a greater proportion of meals for themselves, farmers are struggling to sell certain products and distributors are scrambling to redirect food quickly. Some farmers have been forced to let produce rot in the field or dump oversupplies of milk, while breakouts in meat processing plants have raised concerns about meeting the growing demand for store-ready beef, pork and chicken. American agriculture has been hit hard, like most of America, with the virus, and President Trump is standing with our farmers and all Americans to make sure we get through this national emergency. And the Chinese city of Wuhan, the original epicenter of the virus outbreak, has revised the number of its virus-related facilities up by 1,290 to 3,869. The government of Hebei province, home to Wuhan, said on Friday that the number of casualties have been revised up by half due to late reports from medical institutions and because some patients died at home while hospitals were overloaded in the early stages of the epidemic. Wuhan's Epidemic Prevention and Control Center said it also revised the total number of confirmed cases in the city, where the virus was first reported in December 2019, up by 325 to 50,333. The revisions come as the accuracy of China's data continues to be questioned abroad and by its own citizens. The revision of the official data is likely to fuel speculation about the accuracy of China's figures, which has been questioned by US President Donald Trump. American intelligence officials believe China has concealed the extent of its outbreak and underreported cases and deaths. And Britain's Telegraph newspaper reports that pictures of thousands of ash urns being ferried to funeral homes in Wuhan circulated on Chinese social media platforms in March, raising concerns that the real number of deaths may be a lot higher than officially acknowledged. China has denied intentionally underreporting its cases, but it's also previously revised the data. And back in Australia, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to rule out making it mandatory for Australians to download and use a controversial tracking app to help slow the spread of the virus. Mr. Morrison said at least 40% of the population would need to use the app, which is under development, to make it effective. My preference is to give Australians a go at getting it right, he told Triple M on Friday. That's my plan A, and I really want plan A to work. The Trace Together mobile phone app would help with better contact tracing, one of three main benchmarks the government wants to meet before strict virus restrictions can be lifted. The others are a broader testing regime and a greater capacity to quash local outbreaks. The tracking app is based on one from Singapore, which tracks people's movements with Bluetooth However, even in Singapore, considered a more compliant society than Australia, only 20% of citizens have agreed to share their mobile phone data. Mr. Morrison has linked using the app to national service. I know this would be something they might not normally do at an ordinary time, but this is not an ordinary time, he said. If you download this app, you'll be helping save somebody's life. And Morrison said that the app would not be used by police as evidence to prosecute people for breaching social distancing requirements. Privacy issues are being worked through before an opt-in app is launched, probably within 2 weeks. The minister responsible, Stuart Robert, has told Channel 7 that information gathered by the app would be transferred to a database only if the person who tests positive to COVID-19 agrees. If you tested positive, the authorities would ask you to consent, and that will be uploaded to a secure server, he said. That's it. No one is tracking you. There is no surveillance. And later on Friday, Deputy Chief Medical Officer Paul Kelly said Trace Together would be a crucial and timely extra piece of the puzzle of contact tracing. If we could all do this and everyone had the app on their phones, then this would certainly make this experience much easier, he said. It would allow us to really consider releasing those social distancing measures that we have had in place. I've always been a believer in the Australian people making the right decision, so I think the voluntary approach at first is the way to go. But Labor leader Anthony Albanese, who found out about the app through the media, said it was up to the government to better explain it. Meantime, more analysts are calibrating the fallout, with Damien Boy at Credit Suisse saying that core domestic demand is likely to fall 3.5% annualised in Australia. Near-term inventory builds and bounces in exports could cushion the blow to GDP, but nonetheless, the economy is on track for its worst performance since the early 1990s recession. In March and early April, business and consumer and housing sentiment all plunged. COVID-19 shutdowns have weighed heavily on firms' desire to invest and hire, and consumers have been burdened by job insecurity and public auction bans. The aggregate hours worked will fall 3.8% based on the NAB Business Survey and Employment Index and growth in the ANZ job advertisements. These indicators currently point to a shrinking in aggregate hours worked by 4% annualised in the coming months, he said. Perhaps in the short term, increases in the official unemployment rate will be mitigated by the government's JobKeeper programme and associated reductions in average work weeks. But it's also possible that participation rates will fall and that unemployed secondary income earners will drop out of the workforce to limit the rise in the unemployment rate. And the question is a 10% unemployment rate, as forecast by the Treasury, realistic? To achieve this outcome, he said, we would need to see hours worked fall further. And he suggests officials are bringing back memories of the early 1990s recession in their war gaming with the intention of managing expectations and building the case for more emergency stimulus measures. And the really bad news is that the trend growth in domestic demand has slowed towards zero and may even turn negative. The inflation index bond yield is a powerful leading indicator of trend growth in the interest rate targeting era, with a lead time of roughly 5 years. And it is currently pointing to negligible potential or supply-side growth. Bond market investors are saying that this recession could easily destroy productive capacity by bankrupting businesses. Moreover, if and when demand stabilizes or recovers, we do not get those bankrupt businesses back. We could easily find ourselves in a situation where too much money is chasing too few goods and services, bringing back inflation ahead of time. And that leads to the question that we are actively considering. Is the future one of high inflation and interest rates, as we saw, say, in the 1970s and 80s, or depression and deflation? And this is important, not least to the future trajectory of, for example, gold. I get criticised often by the gold bugs who believe in the inflationary scenario where gold lifts in value, and you can find hundreds of social media sites all playing the same tune, often, by the way, linked to the marketing of gold. On the other hand, if deflation and depression come into the frame, then gold will likely fall in value as it's linked to inflation more closely than many want to admit. And that is, of course, ignoring the fact that paper gold markets are dominated by large players with many hedged and unhedged positions, and the fact that holding gold is quite complex and you cannot eat it. Then, of course, there is the risk of confiscation under the 1959 Act. Gold's more than 2% down on Friday to 1,694. All I'm saying is be fully informed on this contentious issue. And talking of contentious issues, the ABC said that ongoing problems with the troubled Mascot Towers apartment building could see the repair bill blow out to more than $50 million. Leaked emails revealed. Mascot Towers in Sydney's south has been plagued by structural issues and cracking since the complex was evacuated almost a year ago. Now owners are considering selling the beleaguered development. Residents were evacuated when significant cracks were discovered in the building's primary support structures last year and are still to return. Initial estimates put the repairs at $7 million, which would be funded by a special strata levy, but the price tag subsequently blew out to $15 million and then $25 million before this week's estimate of $32 million for rectification works. A further $21.5 million in interest on a 15-year loan would bring the final bill to $53.5 million. That is around $10 million more than previous estimates and equates to an average of about $400,000 for each owner of the 132 units. A confidential email obtained by the ABC was sent to the building's owners on Wednesday night by the Strata Committee. It provides a breakdown of the new costs and concedes that they are significantly higher than initial estimates. In the mail, the Strata Committee blamed recent problems with the building's facade for the increase as an indication of how the costs have continued to mount. A total of $3.8 million has been allocated for the facade repair, the email said. Apartment owner Brian Tucker, who is on the Strata Committee, said owners would be asked to consider a collective sale. He conceded Mascot Towers would likely only sell for its land value. But what do you do, he said. Do we try to get rid of it, but go into debt for the rest of our lives, or keep throwing money into it, but find more and more faults? It's a lose-lose situation. We have to try and find the least worst option. Mr. Tucker said the builder's developer had gone into liquidation and was unable to be held responsible. The New South Wales government is covering rent for displaced owners and residents as rectification works continues and has launched an inquiry into building standards after a series of faults emerged in buildings across Sydney. But owners of Mascot Towers apartments want immediate help and have been warned to brace for more bad news. There is no guarantee that further issues will not be identified in other areas of the building, and we can only address them as they arise, the Strata Committee email read. The problems at Mascot Tower followed similar issues with the Opal Tower at Sydney Olympic Park, which had been evacuated on Christmas Eve in 2018 after several major cracks were found. And of course, Opal Tower and Mascot Towers are just the tip of the iceberg. We know that there are many thousands of properties, both in Sydney and beyond, that are in deep disrepair. And unfortunately, this is due to structural and systemic issues in the building sector, which I think will only come home to roost in the months and years ahead. And finally, before I go, a quick reminder that on Tuesday 21st of April at 8 p.m. Sydney time, I'll be running my next live show. We'll be updating our finance and property scenarios and answering questions via the YouTube live chat, or you can send me a question beforehand via the DFA blog. Given the current market flux, this will be a lively session, and I look forward to seeing you there. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.